You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. And this is actually our seventh and final episode in our Elevate Your Flip series here. So I'm Chris Lopez. I am your host, but our special guest presenter is Derek Marlin. And Derek, it's good to have you back for the seventh one. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So I'm excited to get into this one because to recap over at this point, we started out the series at, you know, an overview, finding deals, analyzing deals, how to figure out what work needs to be done, managing the project. And now we're talking about how to sell it. And that's where you make your profit and cash out, right?
Yeah, exactly. You've done all that hard work. It's time to get some rewards and sell the property off.
So where do we even begin on this? I guess you can probably do a slightly better recap than I did here. But just to kind of give everyone the continuity of the programs here and how you look at items, the last episode really focused on your Monday.com account with your very detailed project management list. So at this point in the process, I'm assuming we're probably towards the end of your project management list on there and we're getting ready to list it, right? So when we jump into listing stuff here, generally how many weeks are we into the contract, the rehab, and then when are you getting all this listing stuff set out to actually list the property?
Yeah, you're typically in the last week of finishing a project. And so you're getting ready to wrap things up with your contractor. You're going over the really fine tooth comb type of detail points on your project so that it's ready to list. And then either working with your real estate professional and real estate agent, if someone's listing on your behalf, or I know a lot of your audience is folks that are agents themselves. So it's almost just maybe shifting their mindset a little bit of how do you get this property ready to list for a fix and flip rather than maybe a traditional listing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's just walk me through the process here. So pretend like I'm one of your clients here. We're in the final stretch of our listing here. I'm assuming we're kind of getting down to our punch list items. What does it look like here?
Yeah, so the first thing you're going to want to do is have a blue tape walkthrough with your contractor. So that's where you literally get your roll of painter's tape. You walk around and you blue tape anything that needs to be addressed. So we went back and forth and found that it is helpful sometimes to have a list, but there's nothing that stands out more than a piece of blue tape that shows you need to have some touch-up paint in one certain area of the house. You might have a grout line that needs to be refilled. You might have a fixture that is a little bit loose for your kitchen cabinet hardware. So really anything that really is on a punch list, which is those very, very fine level amounts of detail. And to help define that, that would be about 1, maybe 2 days worth of work. It should really be the last nitty-gritty details that are in your statement of work. But really the way we try to teach our contractors is if I have new buyers coming into the house, what's going to stick out to them? And when you work with contractors over time, the nice thing is this meeting and this list gets much, much smaller. But when you work with new folks and you're developing these relationships, they don't maybe know, especially at a certain price point, that you have to have every I and you know, dotted and T crossed because that's going to jump out to a buyer.
So when we're doing our final walkthrough with our blue tape, I mean, let's just say we're doing a, you know, normal 3 or 4 bedroom condo or home,
yep,
kind of the bread and butter stuff you do. How long does that walkthrough normally take?
I would break it up into two parts. Either we can do it with the contractor, or what we actually prefer to do is do it by ourselves and do that in advance and then meet with the contractor afterwards. Because inherently, contractors typically say, oh, well, everything is totally done. So I say, great, get everything done to what is kind of your standards. Give me an hour or so, usually 1, maybe 2 hours if it's a larger house, 2,000 square feet or above. Should take us 1 to 2 hours between myself or any of my teammates and team members to do it. And you're doing the blue tape. And then you go back and meet with the contractor, walk around, answer any questions. It should be relatively straightforward and make sure that's done. And then it's done the week before you are getting ready to list the property.
Okay.
And we'll get into that kind of extra timeline here in a minute. But yeah, it's really just buttoning up all those details as to the last week of your project, getting ready to list it the following or the upcoming week.
Now, how thorough of that blue tape walkthrough do you do? Are you opening and closing every cabinet door and drawer and turn every faucet? Like how detailed is it?
Yeah, that's a great point. It is really detailed because the premise is as long as they do everything on that blue tape punch list, you're making the final payment. And when you make that final payment, you're signing the lien waiver or they're signing the lien waiver saying, yes, they've been paid. And theoretically, everybody could walk away and never come back if you feel like everything is done. So yeah, you are turning on the faucets, letting them run for a while to make sure there's no leaks. You are checking all the electrical, using your outlet plug to make sure that you've got correct power.
Oh, so you're going to every outlet too, yeah, and checking for grounds and,
yep,
okay.
You're doing everything. You are using the garage door. If you've put on a new garage door, make sure the opener works. You are making sure the gutters and the downspouts are properly working. I mean, really just anything that you can do that, think of it from a buyer's perspective or even more so from the homeowner or from the homeowner inspection professional that's going to walk through the house when you go under contract. And that's really what we tell our contractors is we need to have this great product for our end buyer so that it sells hopefully quickly and in a best case scenario, maybe multiple offers. But then after that, we know we're going to have a home inspector,
yep,
who is going to go through the project and work on the buyer's behalf. And so we really kind of prep our contractors and say, let's just head all these things off if we can. Inherently, something always comes up, whether fair or kind of unfair. And luckily, you could hopefully have a good relationship with your contractor to come back. But our goal is to test as many things as possible so that you can make that last payment and feel good that if you really had to and they said, I'm retired and moving to Mexico and living on a beach, you don't have to call them back. So that's the goal with the blue tape walkthrough.
You're kind of doing the blue tape walkthrough from the perspective of the home inspector,
yes,
but also from the perspective of the potential home buyer they walk through and they're doing their, you know, walk around and looking, yeah, around at things.
Yep.
So how do you, I understand the home inspector, but from the perspective of the person walking in before they're, you know, they're not testing outlets, yep, they're doing all this stuff. How do you put yourself in their shoes as they walk through?
Yeah, you just try to be as detailed as possible as if you were the person buying a home.
Okay.
And so it's really a matter of standing behind the quality that you've hopefully put all this time and energy and effort into. And you're complimenting the contractor too and saying, hey, we've got this great product. We can't get almost to the finish line. And, you know, if you're using a sports analogy of running a race, you can't run a 400 and run 395 meters. You have to run the 400 meters. And so a good example for us is always touch up paint. So inherently something always gets dinged a little bit.
Oh yeah.
And if you walk in and there is some dings or some drywall scuffs in the entryway, the kitchen might look beautiful, but that buyer's eye is drawn to a little bit of chipped drywall. Another good example is the front door. If you don't put door stops on the back of your doors, a subcontractor is going to walk in, the door is going to swing open, and your lock is going to damage the drywall behind, mm-hmm, that front door. So even something as simple, if you walk in, your buyer closes the door and they see a little, you know, dime size hole in the drywall. You shouldn't ideally have that. So it's thinking from the buyer's perspective of what's going to jump out. And then we always know that even though there might not be a woman in the buying process, we always look at it as they're going to have the more critical eye and make the end decision. And so I really just try to have not only one of my employees who's a female, actually have my wife walk through it because I'm married. I typically will have our stager walk through and just, again, more eyes on it, the better. And then I'm kind of the final, you know, piece of the puzzle to make sure it's done properly.
So your comment there about the little dings and stuff, it made me think of, I mean, this was in high school and college, I worked for a general contractor who did like home additions.
Yeah.
I mean, renovations and add on, you know, 1,000 square feet to a property. And I was just, you know, the cheap $10 sure, an hour labor, but it was a great learning experience. And one of the things I remember that stuck out to me was they said, everyone asked me, like, they're like, where is the most important room in the house to paint the best? And their answer was the bathroom.
Sure.
And that's because, you know what? Everyone's sitting on the toilet.
Yeah.
And what else do you have to do but sit around and look? And this was like before iPhones and, you sure, know, all that stuff. But I was like, yeah, that's really interesting because I never thought about that. Like, yeah, it's those little things where, like, where do people's eyes go to? Because they say, hey, if the paint and the caulking and the tile grout lines in the bathroom,
yeah,
are, you know, not great, And that's where they actually look at the detailed stuff. Well, then they assume all the other work is that same sloppiness.
Right.
And I was like, that makes a lot of sense. And you're saying the same thing. Just, hey, you get those little details lined up because it just really makes every the buyer realize, hey, they did a really good job here and all the details are finalized.
It does, because you got to think about you're under competition for other properties in general. And then in our market, which is pretty competitive, there's typically another finished fix and flip that they're going to evaluate yours against theirs. And historically, sometimes people that have done fix and flips don't do the best job and are trying to squeeze every bit of margin out of it. And not using the best contracting work. And so you want to kind of dispel that myth that, okay, it is a fix and flip and we want it to be almost like a new home rather than something that feel like somebody just, you know, slapped up some product from Home Depot and hopes and crosses your fingers that it's going to go well. But no, we look at every detail. Maybe a good example would be is if you're closing kitchen cabinet doors and the bottom of those doors don't line up, that's called the reveal. So if you're off even by about a 16th of an inch and you close both cabinet doors and one cabinet door looks like it's just a little bit lower than the other one, we have our contractors fix that. So even just little things like that to make sure that everything works, or if you spend the money to do soft closed doors for your kitchen cabinets, you got to make sure that each one of those closes nicely and properly, because we're promoting it in the listing saying maple cabinets, dovetail construction, soft close. And if they open the first three and it doesn't close or it sticks out or whatever, again, they just think, oh, what's wrong with the rest of the house? So you just got to think of it from that perspective.
Plus, I'm sure we'll get in this, but if the house is, you know, vacant or not staged, there's very few things for buyers to look at.
Yes.
And what they do is open and shut cabinet doors and drawers because there's nothing else to touch or look at.
Yeah, exactly.
And that stuff has a big impact. It's, yeah, okay, that's one or two drawers there, and that's what they focus on. All right, so that's the final punch list here. Yep. So let's get into, I think, pricing the property. Like, I'm assuming that's kind of like, and I know you already have that already kind of figured out when you bought the property.
Sure.
But, hey, the market has changed slightly. We're 2, 3, 4 months ahead of the schedule. How do you actually get down to a competitive pricing strategy? What's your philosophy here?
Yeah, our philosophy, and we really go back to kind of some of my finance background, and we use a term called velocity of money, and that is how fast can I move my money? And to define that better, it's how many properties can we do in a single year with a specific amount of money? So the way that correlates to pricing is, we hear a lot of investors that say, oh man, I went over budget or it took me a little bit longer, so now I'm going to price it more. The house is worth what it's going to be worth. I mean, within reason, as long as you fix it up well, there's ways that people can push the price and add value to a property. But you know, long ago when I was little and didn't really understand, and now it's kind of ironic, but you know, my dad told me something's worth what someone's willing to pay for it. So if you don't do a good job, they're not going to be willing to pay very much. Versus if you do a great job, or more so price it very competitively, there's going to be more people that hopefully theoretically are going to be willing to pay more for your property. So we always look at, you're right, comps on the front end to determine what we think we can sell for on the back end. Then coming on the home stretch, the reality of pricing it is we always want to price it slightly below any active properties that are on the market that are 100% fixed up. We're definitely going to be priced more than a nicely updated homeowner property. But again, we don't just tack on X dollars. We don't really have a certain percentage per se of pricing X percent above another listing. We just look at what's the square foot cost of other properties on the market. The best case scenario is there's another flip that's been sold, so that can help dictate our price. But we really want it to be, for what it is, the by far the best quality product at a super reasonable price. And I would rather price it a touch low and hopefully have some folks bid it up. Or in our philosophy is that normally I'd rather have multiple buyers that I can pick from, and the price is going to go where it's going to go. Rather than you have a price point of, let's say, $500,000 in mind, you ended up spending an extra $6,000 because of delays, because of, you know, for whatever reason that the budget goes over, you can't just price it at 506 or 510 or even 515. In our opinion, it's always priced to where the market is. Go under contract fast, go under contract with the right buyer, keep it under contract, sell it once and move along.
That makes sense.
Don't hold out.
And I mean, from all the data I see and just the experiences I have as an agent, you're exactly right. The prices that are a little bit below fair market value, way more eyeballs in the listing, more people through the door, more phone calls to the agent, more offers, better pricing, because multiple people bid it up. versus multiple people bidding it down.
Correct.
Okay. And of course, that just feeds into like, hey, don't worry about a couple dollars on the back end because you just want to get the money and move on to the next project because you'll get more, make more money on that money then, right? Going back to your velocity of money.
Yeah. I mean, 100%. If you think about, oh, I'm going to price it 10 grand more because you feel like you're on the edge and you could maybe push the price. But if that sits in our current conditions, if it sits for more than a month, you're 100% going to look at a price reduction. So there goes that amount of money. You've probably paid interest for an extra month. And usually if you do one project delay of not selling it within a month or two, you technically may not have been able to get to that last flip within the year. And if your average price, you know, net profit is $25,000 to let's say $50,000, that cost you 25 or 50 grand within 1 year, all things being consistent. So again, it's not just this random, oh, I'm going to try to get a touch more. I mean, you've kind of technically cost yourself money by not selling it and moving it along and trying to get maybe one more project in within a year.
And we got a, you got a note here in the show notes talking about, maximizing curb appeal during seasonality. So first off, what is seasonality and what do you do to maximize the curb appeal?
Yeah, so great point. We really try to look at where are those comps and what can we price it for. If we do see prices going up, because we're pretty conservative on the front end when we're buying the property, thinking our ARV or after repair value is relatively conservative. If we see in the project takes us 3 months, we're hitting it, let's say in the summertime or the spring when it's typically best as a seller to put the property on the market, we'll really weigh those benefits. And one of the main areas that we look at is putting pergolas on properties. So that's the cool wooden structure on the back that gives you that nice area for outdoor entertaining. You know, depending upon the size of the pergola, you're looking at anywhere from $1,000 to $2,500 for a pergola. But you can really potentially add that on and up the price if you feel like the market is moving that way, because the perceived value of that addition is typically far greater than how much it costs to do it.
Really?
Only if you see the market running that way and you've been on budget. If you get to the end and you've hit your budget, then we're not going to add something like that. Seasonality talks about you're going to have to spend a bit more on landscaping and curb appeal in the spring and the summer to have the property looking really, really good versus the winter time when you still want the property nice and cleaned up. You ideally want your mulch beds put in, either if the property has existing grass or you have areas for sod, you want it totally turnkey, but you don't need to spend as much on landscaping because in Colorado, at least, we're going to have snow on the ground potentially. So it's just really looking at when you're hitting the market and how much you're doing on that last little bit. The other area that we'll do a lot of times, and we'll have this as a part of our overall budget, but building planter beds or flower beds, good way to take up a big chunk of, you know, square footage in the backyard that looks unfinished from time to time. And, you know, you're talking about a couple $100 in lumber and labor to finish this type of backyard. Or we'll do a really cool fire pit area where we'll bring in a product called Breeze. That's that really kind of fine road base. We will put together a self-contained fire pit and we'll buy four Adirondack chairs from Home Depot. And you're talking an all-in price of $300 or $400 to have this cool defined fire pit area. You know, go to Costco, pay $50 for market lights, and you've got this outdoor entertainment area for $600. Again, if you're doing it in the summertime, that stuff you want to do. Wintertime, it's going to be covered by snow and you're not going to really get that return out of it. So we're always just trying to be kind of strategic and creative in how we're finishing the project and then how it corresponds to pricing.
Now, what about on the interior? Are you, your thoughts on staging? I mean, worth the money or not? Or
100% worth the money on every, I have never not staged a property at any price point.
Really?
Even in a seller's market, we do condos and townhomes and we stage condos and townhomes. On average, our staging pricing is $1,000 to $2,000 per property. And that's for the consulting fee of our stager to come in and do the work and stage it and the furniture rental. You're going to end up paying the furniture rental if you keep the furniture in the property, say another month or two. But we are 100% committed to staging everything. And myself and fellow investors feel that staging absolutely gets you more eyeballs on your property. You had the great point earlier of if it's empty, people are looking almost for more deficiencies mm-hmm. than the nice nature of our product. And we have people a lot of times that ask if they can even buy the staging because they never would have thought about the layout. And that's honestly, especially even in smaller spaces, people don't really think about how efficient and how much furniture you can get in a property unless it's staged on their behalf.
Yeah.
So we really almost look at staging small properties just as important as large ones because it really helps you maximize what your property can be, especially if you don't have a defined dining room, for example. We will still always stage every single property.
Okay, so that's the definitive thumbs up there.
Yeah, very much so.
What about, because I know you list your properties mostly in-house, right?
We do.
Mm-hmm. What about just flipping in general before you had your team? Like, how does the flipper go out there and find the right agent, or what do you look for?
That's a great question. And that's something that we had in our notes too. So, you know, inherently people have some sort of connection to a real estate agent, whether it's a spouse, a family member, you know, the Kevin Bacon, one connection of separation away.
Everyone's you got know a cousin an that's an agent.
Everybody does. But what I would really caution people to do is, and this might not make Thanksgiving dinner that much fun, but hopefully you can pay for Thanksgiving dinner with the profit you make on your flip. I would 100% hire a licensed agent that has expertise in selling fixed up, flipped properties. You know, I think ideally 5 to 10 would be that sweet spot because that person's going to know how to better negotiate on your behalf and be your biggest advocate versus, you're right, your cousin who lists two properties a year on the side because they might have a corporate job and they do it to help make a little bit of extra commission. That's great. That person should be supported in what they do, but they should not be the person that you use to flip or list your flip on your behalf.
And before you brought it in the house, I mean, I know a pretty common strategy for investors and flippers are, hey, agent, if you bring me the deal, you get to sell the deal on the back end. Is that a similar mindset in the way you've operated and found to be successful?
100%. That's exactly how we started is if somebody brought us a deal, we would they would typically earn the full commission on the front end, whether that was an on-market deal and they were earning that percentage or even off-market deals, we would pay them as a flat fee, essentially, whatever that commission would have been. So they're making kind of that full commission on the front end. And then we would typically say, hey, we hopefully will do some volume with you. We'll make your life really, really easy to have a great finished product. We'll do all of the paperwork, make it so that it's hopefully a minimal commitment time-wise on their behalf. So will they give us a kind of a deal or a flat rate or something on the back end? And then we're 100% great to commit to them to sell that property on the back end.
Do you normally
if
ask
I'm doing
like,
volume?
Like 1%? Because that's a lot of times what I've seen people a lot of times list for 1%. Or do you have like a different strategy in mind?
Usually 1 to 1.5%. Yep, is something that we'll do. And then if we end up doing more deals with somebody, hopefully they lean towards that 1%. If we end up not doing that many, then we want to be fair too. If it's a one-off from here or there, we're fine with paying people more. But ideally, you want to kind of commit, let that person list it on the back end, and hopefully, again, you're saving them time, not as much as a traditional listing, and then hopefully they're feeling it's fair to come down a little bit in compensation and do more business with you.
Okay. So I'm interested about this bullet point here on our show notes is you've got your elevation toolbox.
Yeah.
That's borrowed from your wife who's a wedding planner.
Yep.
And so I have high expectations and interest in hearing what this is, seeing the work you do. And I imagine she has a very successful business as well. So explain this to me.
Yeah. So kind of thinking of the timeline of you have your contractor blue tape meeting, you've got everything refined and dialed in, you're getting ready to make your final decision on the price. We have professional cleaners come in and clean the property, and we'll talk about really what we call the listing week and what
we
did each
day. There?
Yeah.
Talk about the difference between having your GC clean up the property and having a cleaning company come clean up your property. Because I've seen the two differences.
That's a great, that's such a good point. Two things. One, they are vastly different. A professional cleaning company is somebody who's going to get your property clean enough to put it on the market and again, have, a couple, an individual, whomever as a buyer come through and say, man, this is a really nice, super clean property. Contractor clean is what we call broom clean. So that is they've done all the work and they've vacuumed and just swept up the property in general to make it efficient for the professional cleaners to come in. I would not put it on their plate to clean it up because one, it's not going to be as good as it needs to be. And two, one way or the other, you're getting charged for that. And it's just, it's not an efficient use of the contractor's time either. So wrapping up with them, the blue tape meeting is, hey guys, everything's just got to be swept up. All the materials have to be taken out of the garage. You guys take your stuff. You're ready to roll, hopefully for the next project. And then yes, then you contract through a professional cleaning company that comes in and is kind of the hands and knees type of cleaners to get it sparkling clean for your listing. So yeah, that's a super important point. So, but we still found that when we were trying to translate how clean and how detailed we want the end product to be to our professional cleaners, there was still a little bit left to be desired. This might be me being overly involved. But what I did was my wife owns a wedding planning business and she literally from early on has this monstrous toolbox on wheels that she would bring to weddings. And it had every single thing a bride or person in the bridal party would ever need to ever go wrong at a wedding. Well, I said, if she can have this work successfully on someone's most important day of their life, I think we should be able to kind of borrow that idea and take it to a fix and flip. So what we did is we have our own toolbox that we show up with myself and my team and punch list, blue tape meeting has happened. And typically the professional cleaning has already happened, but inherently you're going to want to go in there with a, you know, a couple different simple tools that you might need to tighten something here or there that maybe you missed in the blue tape meeting. So a cabinet pull or something of that. For me, I always bring in those Mr. Clean Magic erasers. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to know what chemical is really in that, but that will take off the weirdest scuffs.
Amazing.
They're super amazing. They will clean any little kind of detail that you might miss from blue tape or professional cleaning. The razor blades that have the handles on them so that you can get off. Perfect example is contractor puts up a light. There's the tag on that light that talks about the wattage of the bulb. Well, again, you don't want the buyer seeing this nice light with the wattage tag on it. We'll try to get the cleaners to take it off, but from time to time, you just need a little razor to get that, you know, done. Or maybe there's a little overspray on the windows. We make sure that the windows are super clean so that you get the most light in there as possible. So you kind of, we come in with our toolbox of about 15 different things that we use to get the house ready to list it. We bring in air fresheners. We bring in front door mats. We just do all these little kind of details in our little toolbox that we walk in the front door with to make sure that truly every single detail is accounted for.
So is this a toolbox you bring and basically leave on site until offer accepted? And
yeah, that's a really good question. We've thought about that. We've ended up needing them for other projects, so we'll just take it around. Okay. We end up usually leaving, you know, a roll of paper towels and some cleaner in there so that we can just quickly grab something in a Swiffer to clean up in between showings or if something gets dirty over a kind of a busy weekend. But we don't really leave it there because we are usually going from project to project and using our toolkit to 100% clean it up. But it's just been something that's been super, super effective to make sure that you just have everything completely dialed in before people are going to put eyeballs on it as a potential buyer.
I'm really glad to see that you have the front door mat in that toolkit because that was one of my pet peeves. Now, again, we're like 95% plus on the buy side, but we go to, you know, listings and there's no doormat. And hey, Colorado, we have rain and snow and rock salt. It's like, just put a damn doormat there. Like it would make it so much less messy.
No, it is. It's such an important part. And I think that that helps. It's almost that can fall under your curb appeal that we have a big doormat, a big welcome mat on the outside of the house. And then you walk in and you have entry doormats at the front and the back door. So you're right. People can wipe off their shoes. We even really have gravitated towards in condo complexes. We'll continue to try to make nice to our neighbors. Those that have listened to the series, they'll know that we've handed out flyers to them early on the project saying we want it to be a professional job, call us with any issues. We'll go back through, we'll try to be as nice as possible, knowing, hey, good news, you're going to have a really nice new neighbor who's going to be in here in a polite way. We're saying they're buying a fixed up product, so they're probably going to want to take great care of it. We want them leading up to their unit, everything to be clean. So we will literally clean the entire stairwell of a condo complex wherever our potential buyer sees themselves walking up. We just did one over in Central Denver where there were exterior entries in the condo complex. So we bought new front door mats for all six people that were in that stairwell. We cleaned out all the cobwebs and just literally kind of cleaned out any entryway they would be near them, and then made sure that the person who decided to, you know, smoke three packs of cigarettes did that, hopefully not just before our listing, or again, we'd politely clean up on their behalf. I've literally mowed neighbors' yards for them to make sure that that curb appeal is there just to go above and beyond. Can be an interesting conversation, but yeah, it's just something that we feel is super worth it.
We're not mowing their yard at 2 o'clock in the morning to sneak it in there.
We're not. Ironically, I had one guy who got mad at me for asking, because his yard was in really bad shape, and we politely said, hey, we've put a lot of time and energy and money into this house. We want to do the best we can, give you nice new neighbors. And I mowed, and he finally begrudgingly said, okay. We mowed his yard, and then he was mad when I didn't mow it the next 3 weeks. So I'm like, man, I give you one free mow. That's about as good as I can get. But yeah, just those little detail points. We've done air fresheners on interior condos behind entry doors so that it smells good from the second they walk in that entry door up 3 or 4 flights of stairs to our property. So we just feel like it all really adds to that experience of buying
a house. Those details are smart.
Yep.
So, okay. So what is your just timeline like here?
Yeah. Yeah. Our ideal timeline doesn't always work this way, but we really pride ourselves in trying to make sure that this is really dialed in. And I've learned from rushing a property on the market early on in my career of, let's say, listing it on a Monday because your carrying costs are ticking away and you want to just get it on the market, to what we now see as our ideal timeline. So that's Monday, the professional cleaning happens. Tuesday, professional staging happens. Wednesday, professional photos happen. We tried to condense those from time to time, whether you did cleaning in the morning, staging in the afternoon, or staging in the morning, photos in the afternoon. Inherently, something happens. So we just figure, and have learned from experience, just one day per item is probably most realistic. So you stage it on a Wednesday. Thursday, that we do kind of combo things in. So Thursday morning is our elevation toolbox, kind of walk through and nitty gritty cleaning. You're getting the photos professionally done. You usually get them back on Thursday morning. You list the property on the MLS on Thursday afternoon. And then we do showings starting on Friday morning is our deal timeline. We've sometimes done an open house the Saturday. So you're boom, boom, boom. You're going day by day. We found that for us, open houses don't really sell the property necessarily. Yeah. For us, it's been far better for lead generation of trying to actually meet our neighbors, trying to buy other properties. And we just don't find many unrepresented, you know, buyers, for example. So we've really migrated over the last year to having our open house the Saturday after you go on the market. So you're able to get some nice showings. Many times we're ideally under contract, but again, our goal is not to, we don't think it sells the house. We'd rather meet people that we might actually be able to potentially buy the house. And we've already kind of had the buyers come through, and we want to more meet the neighbors or people kind of in the area for open house.
So doing that, say, 2 week timeline of you start cleaning and then the second weekend you have the open house.
Yep.
If you already got offers on the table and are contract, you're still doing the open house.
Yes.
More for the meet the neighbors and lead gen versus.
Exactly. Okay. Yep. Yep. So we really don't get many buyers through once it is under contract. But in the market now, with it being a little seasonably slower in the wintertime, usually properties don't, even if they're priced really well, don't go under contract that first weekend. It takes about 7 days for those to go under contract. So you'll hit it perfectly where you'll have that open house. It'll still be not under contract, or we'll be getting offers, but we won't have earnest money and it won't be officially tied up.
Okay.
We just found that by doing it that very next Saturday, we just didn't have a lot of traction. Or also, you didn't get those professional pictures back until Thursday morning to then kind of promote that anyway. So we found that doing it on a Saturday, the following Saturday, has been a little more beneficial.
And I'm assuming your hope here with the timing here, if you're going live in MLS on Thursday, showings start Friday. I mean, ideal timeline, offers are coming in that weekend. Mm-hmm. Monday, you review everything and hopefully accept or counter an offer that Monday or Tuesday, right? Because that's what we see a lot of times.
Yep, those are definitely the way we try to gear it towards, is having a ton of activity that first weekend, price it appropriately. Another kind of nuance that we happen to subscribe to is, we would rather have as many people through the property as possible. We don't put on our listing notes what we're asking our buyers or their agents to conform to, which is, We're assuming we're going to get a bunch of offers. We want everybody to have the offers in. We'll review them by Monday and we'll get back to you on Tuesday. Well, what if that doesn't happen? So kind of my counterintuitive nature is always, if I'm on their side or in their shoes and you don't have an offer and you've promoted that, I'm going to give you a lower offer. So we just say, hey, we respectfully would love any offers to come in as soon as people are comfortable making them. We'll review them as quickly as possible and we'll get back to you. Our philosophy is always, we want to find the right buyer. I've actually taken times where the price has actually been lower because I knew that it was the right buyer who was going to actually close on the property. So again, we'd rather just have as much activity as possible rather than stating in the listing notes the way that we think your transaction is going to happen. Yeah. And assuming we're going to get multiple offers. And if we get them, great. And then we quickly tell people, hey, we do have multiple offers, but I'd rather have my real estate agent and our acquisitions manager who sells our properties have that conversation with them than just blanket putting it out there and thinking, oh, we got a great product and we know we're going to get multiple offers. I never assume that.
Or if you put that in the show notes or the show notes, the listing notes out there, mm-hmm. which a lot of times on like the broker private remarks for the brokers to see is, doesn't happen. Yeah. Move those damn notes, because I can't. So often we look at properties.
Oh, totally.
And you know, let's just say we're in like the last couple of days of December here.
Yeah.
And it'll be a November listing. Hey, we'll take all the offers on November 28th. I'm like, oh, that was a month ago.
Yeah.
Okay. We haven't gotten the offers. Which again, we like, cool. We know we can probably eat on the price a little bit then.
100%. I agree. I mean, that can't scream any more of a lower bid coming down the pipeline. Yeah. I'm completely with you. And I think all these little details just show how professional either you are or your team is. So again, that I think harkens back to hiring a really good agent that has experience with listing fix and flips and would know either let's not put that verbiage in up front,
yeah.
or if you do, let's quickly take it off. So I think that kind of goes back to having a person who's got this experience than, you know, the cousin who's listing it for you.
So how do you define a buyer that truly loves your house? Yeah, how do you figure that out? Because I mean, we write our offers, again, for our buyers, usually rental property owners. You know, we write our offers to be very attractive to the seller,
right.
Timing, you know, timeline-wise, limited inspection, all this stuff.
Yep.
But, you know, we're not owner-occupants. And so how do you determine, hey, great, buyer two really likes this property more than buyers one and three?
And this is where, again, I think that real estate agent really helps make their money is I ask our team member or someone working on your behalf as an agent to pick up the phone, don't text, don't email,
yes.
get, and I don't care how, and I'm really emphatic about this, I don't care how they might like to do business. I really, really push to get that person on the phone. And we tell them this is just to say in a competitive bidding environment, we want to talk to you. Tell me more about your client. We obviously want to vet from a lender perspective to know that they truly have been qualified, not that they have a pulse and could get a mortgage, but that they're 100% qualified. And I want our agent to talk to the buyer's agent and find out, give me why they love this house. And we just straight up ask them. And if you can get somebody on the phone, they'll typically tell you, hey, my buyer grew up in this neighborhood. Mom and dad live four streets over. They're expecting their first kiddo and it's easy to babysit and they went to XYZ high school. I know, I shouldn't say no. I have a good sense that person wants my specific house than a person who is new to town, out looking at a bunch of different properties and might have offers on three different things. We want to know these little details of, oh, they, you know, are mid-century modern aficionados. They are moving in from out of state. They had a mid-mod in Idaho and they're moving to Denver. They love this property. Again, everybody could totally lie to our faces, but I think the more we can get the information out of them, or they've been looking for 8 months, four deals have fallen through and she loves this property, I'd rather put my eggs in that basket than somebody we don't get any read on and it's all about trying to pick up the phone.
Yeah, I agree there. So, you know, hopefully you're under contract pretty soon here. And you know, the biggest hurdle in any property transaction is the inspection.
Right.
And sounds like, I'm guessing you guys usually have probably pretty good inspection lists because you put out a good product.
Mm-hmm.
But what type of inspection items, inspection objections do you get? And then where is kind of your general rule of thumb for negotiation? Hey, we'll take care of this stuff and this stuff. No, guys, just, It's a 30-year-old house, deal with it. Like,
yeah, that's a great point. What we try to do, again, if it's multiple offers, that gives us a lot more leverage to really politely tell people, hey, just so you know, we do have multiple offers. Ideally, hopefully we have backups. So we're only going to really gravitate towards things that come up that are health and safety related. Ideally, we've already addressed those in our scope of work and fixed up the property. I mean, there's not many times where we're not doing something. The only thing that from time to time we will do, or actually I should say hold off on, is a water heater. If I've got a water heater that's 7 or 8 years old, it's getting close to its end of life expectancy. We've had a lot of them last 12 to 14 years, but in a really hot market, I know that ideally a person that's a very understandable repair, not a huge dollar item repair. And if I've got five offers, I'll just say, hey, I'm going to take the person who probably won't make me replace the hot water heater versus someone who will. And I also know that that's a really quick item that if it comes up on the inspection list, we only have one offer on the table and there's not much else going on. I know I can have a contractor in and out there in one day and have a brand new water heater. That's super straightforward. Versus this health and safety. And we just tell them, another good example is radon. Mm-hmm. That's something that comes up in Colorado a lot because we've got basements. I get it. I've got kids. If you've got somebody living in the basement and the radon levels come in high, that's something we're going to put in a radon system. Versus the one I always laugh about is we had a property in the Highlands, which is a highly sought after part of Metro Denver, multiple offers. And we went under contract and we said, hey, again, health and safety, we've totally fixed up this house. This is what it should be. And this is also where your agent should hopefully be able to see when they're negotiating against an agent who might not have the level of experience or savvy. And they just sent us the inspection report as their list of objections and wanted us to do everything on the inspection report.
You've gotten that as inspection objections? Just the report forwarded?
Just the report, which blew me away. And
wow.
We just politely told them, we're not going to clean your gutters. That was one of the things on their inspection objection list, was that the gutters were dirty. And we just said, well, it's September and leaves fall and you know, either clean your own gutters or we have multiple backup offers. So we do want them to know, like, hey, if there's something that we missed or something breaks in between when we finish the property to the 2 or 3 weeks later when we go under contract and do the inspection, we'll fix it. But it's typically not, you know, it's a health and safety thing. Don't tell me the gutters are dirty. Don't tell me that. I'm trying to think of another good one that would be kind of another classic one is that the inspector goes through and says that the furnace needs to be evaluated by a professional, cleaned and serviced and certified. And I literally just put in a new furnace a month before. So you just kind of politely tell them it's a new furnace. We're good to go. But yeah, kind of only bring me health and safety issues. If it's a property where you've been on the market a little bit longer, you really start to need to weigh the benefit of, if I'm paying interest for the month, how much is it going to cost me to carry it another month?
Yeah.
Or again, that velocity of money, how much is it going to cost me to maybe not flip another property versus either fix something that you might not have planned on originally doing, maybe a little bit of a price concession if it's a little bit softer market. So we really try to be smart about picking the right buyer first that truly loves that house. If they come back with reasonable things and it's a little slower, I'm smart. I'll do a little price concession if it makes sense to do so to keep everybody happy and move on versus if I've got five offers and we've put this amazing product on there and there's every permit pulled in the world, clean your own gutters, you know.
So what happened with that property in the Highlands with the gutters and all that? Did they cancel or did they go through with it?
Oh, no, they went through with it in a heartbeat.
Okay.
And I think, again, it's kind of a qualitative type of thought process. But at the end of the day, what we try to do, and good for them, if they've got a really good agent who's trying to negotiate and get every single penny off for them or do the best they can for their client, hey, I commend them. But we all think about, is the buyer going to let this deal fall apart?
Yeah.
And they're not. And again, we put our name and we actually put signage in the house that says property proudly redeveloped by Elevation. We want them to know, hopefully, that we're building a brand
over time.
Oh, so you're
doing some branding in there too.
Yeah, we're doing branding in the house to know that, hey, this is not just your generic Home Depot flip. This is something that's different. Hopefully over time, if we deal with enough agents, they're going to say, no, these guys know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Go on our website, see who we are, see how many houses we've done and what we put out there than the generic flip or more so that, hey, we know your buyer wants the house, then let's just, you know, figure this out, hopefully. Because they're getting this great product. And you're right. It's not a brand. If you want a new build, go buy a new build. And that's fine. But this is a house from 1950 that looks amazing and is brand newly redone, but it's not a new house.
So what other things, assuming we get past the inspection here, which is the biggest hurdle, yeah, in the contract process that blow deals up. I mean, from there, a lot of times, like, you know, if you get past the inspection, it's usually pretty smooth water afterwards.
Yeah.
Any other like key dates or hurdles that you guys run into between the inspection and closing?
Yeah. So kind of your key dates coming after that is you clear the inspection and appraisal comes up next. That's another date that is important to not only track, but know it's a reason that a buyer could potentially back away from your property. That also goes back to the pricing strategy of, you know, this was a little more last year, our market's normalized a little bit, but yeah, there were a couple of times where we priced it competitively, it ran up a lot. I'm talking $30,000 or $40,000 where I start to think this house might not appraise. So again, let's go with the best offer, them writing the offer that says that they'll actually cover the gap between where an appraisal might come in versus the price that you're under contract with. That puts that person to the top of my list, for example. But knowing that an appraisal is coming up and that if you've got it priced reasonably, that appraiser should come in at where it needs to come in at. We also have our comps pulled, and any buyer's agent is going to do the same thing, hopefully for the appraiser, but we want them to know why we priced the house where we did. So we'll actually print off in color detailed analysis of the most pertinent five or six comps and leave it on the kitchen table for the appraiser to look at when they're hopefully pulling, so that we're, you know, I used to think that they would look at the same comps, and many times they didn't, or they wouldn't look at the right square footage, or there's all these crazy things that can happen. So again, provide as much information,
yep,
for that appraiser as possible to make their job as easy as humanly possible.
Do you provide them like the scope of work and the budget things? Hey, wow, these guys did all this work and put this money in here as well. Like, do you leave that Excel spreadsheet printed out on there?
You know what? That's a really great point. We have thought about it. I haven't done that yet. We are quick to provide that when it's requested.
Okay.
So if it's requested, what I'll usually do is provide them, yeah, our monstrous spreadsheet that shows, you know, a 7 to 12 page statement of work. An interesting kind of side note is we get people that sometimes ask us what we paid or what the amount of money we've invested in the property. I push back on that personally because A, I think that's none of their business.
Yep.
And it's them trying to back into what my margin should be as a person who is doing this business, which
I
is a whole different.
That. Like, oh, they bought for this. They should sell for this.
Yeah.
World doesn't work that way.
It really doesn't. I mean, you can't do that when you're buying your car, when you're doing all these other things. You can't do that when you go to Best Buy and buy a new set of appliances, which we politely remind them of. But we're happy to say, hey, here's our overall super detailed scope of work. If it's a job where we've pulled permits on it, we provide all the permits. And we never had any issues where they say, wait, I don't think that the amount of work that you say you did would correspond to it being priced or valued at this amount. So we usually don't have a hard time. I would say we probably get the request for a scope of work probably only about 35% of the time.
From the appraiser?
From the appraiser. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really feel like normally when they go in there, they can see the quality of work. Again, it's priced well, but not astronomically higher than the rest of the market. So they can really run their own analysis and say, yeah, this makes sense.
And that, I mean, I think it all comes down to what you said at the beginning of the episode of, I mean, you're pricing it well and competitive,
yeah,
which makes everything just smoother down the road.
Yeah, and we've even had, and shockingly, they don't tell me the number, but they say, wow, it actually appraised over value. And I quickly say, well, let's raise the price. And nobody returns my call on that one. But we feel like we've done it fairly so that it actually comes in from time to time and say, actually, it came in over value. I'm like, great, you've got equity in your home.
Yep.
I'm happy for you. You know, hopefully it's karma that comes around and everybody's happy.
And it's amazing how many times appraisals come in right at value.
Yes.
Sarcastically.
Yes, that's another good one. I, you know, and again, that's why we're like, let's just provide that information, yeah, to hopefully make somebody's job easier. And it's a win-win for everybody.
And so, I think that's really smart. It's just, again, always put yourself in the other person's shoes, the appraiser. You know, they're a person, they're busy like most people. If you make their life and their job mm-hmm. easier, and also some, hey, we're looking at this stuff too, great. They're going to hopefully use information and it comes back to you.
Well, and again, you can't assume that they are pulling from the same data set that you are. And I'll bring up two, I think, really good examples. One are mid-century modern homes. We will use a wider comp radius, which most people do quarter mile, maybe half mile, don't cross over any major roads, to pull your comparable sales, which is super fair on a traditional house where you've got a lot of comps. But when you look at mid-centuries, normally the radius, we've actually pulled up to about 2 miles. From time to time, we've crossed major roads as long as it's not completely different neighborhoods per se. And we've explained that to the appraiser to say, hey, this is a really unique mid-century modern home. We did one where it was a really big footprint and had a big basement. So there were very few that were of those that were around. And so we pulled a pretty big wider comp radius. And the appraiser actually said, you know what, that's fair and that's a good point. I don't know if they would have actually pulled that data. And our number came in easily at value versus we, you know, if you looked at it cost per square foot, we were way higher. But there's a premium for certain things. Or we did another one where it was a 3-car garage with a super amazing kind of work area. And we tried to pull at least a couple of those that had bigger oversized garages to, again, help kind of justify the cost. And who knows, they might have picked that up, but we don't want to leave that, you know, to chance.
And actually, before we hit record on this episode today, you and I were just chatting about closings in general. And you made an interesting comment. You know, sounds for past appraisal, we're good to go to the closing table now. That the main reason you go to the closing is to build your brand and help network for deals. So
yeah,
re-explain that what you said to me earlier for the audience. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's something that I kind of thought back of. Again, I try to put myself in the buyer's shoes. And it kind of actually comes back to my days in the corporate world when I worked for the Broncos. And it was always, I want to go and a boss that I had, instead of sitting up in the luxury suite watching the game from a great vantage point, he would actually go suffer through traffic, parking, walking through the stadium, getting a cold hot dog, you know, whatever kind of craziness might come up, and put yourself in that person's shoes. So I try to think of it in our business of how could we do that? And it's also building our brand. So some people might think, oh, well, that person doesn't want to show up at the closing table because they're hiding something or they don't want to stand behind what they do. I want to look at them eye to eye. I want to thank them. They're spending a ton of money on our property. Even if it's a $200,000 condo or if it's an $800,000 Wash Park home, I want to thank them. I want to build the brand. I want to tell them, hey, if something is like reasonable and kind of goes wrong or is weird, 9 times out of 10, we'll probably either have a warranty on it or we've got a back end kind of a warranty with our contractor. So I'll say, no, that was weird. I'll just send my guy over to go fix it. I want to build a relationship with them so that hopefully if they have other rental properties they might want to sell, maybe they might want to partner up and we'll flip together. The big thing is they'll get to know their neighbors, and we work in areas where we've bought in an area that has a lot of seniors. They're getting to know their neighbors. So I want them, when they know their neighbors, to say, hey, this is how they fixed it up. They might have a better rapport with that person who's ready to make a life change. I want to hopefully get that. I'll pay a buyer of my property a referral fee, a 4-figure referral fee as a thank you. I then want my agent to build rapport with that buy side agent, give them a bottle of wine. We give usually the buyer a bottle of champagne and a thank you card. But let's network and connect with that other person, because when they have a kind of disastrous house that might not be listed, we want to buy. So again, any way we can kind of build rapport or build our brand, we 100% want to do it. And it's tough. We were talking about earlier. It's a time commitment, but I figure, you know what? It's still worth it. And we still try to make it to every closing unless it's back to back or I'm traveling or something like that. But no, I like to sit across the table, shake their hand, thank them. We've also picked up side contracting business for, I want to close out the property. If they say, oh man, we really want to build a 2-car garage, but nobody will return our call. Hey, no problem. I'll either connect you with a contractor. If it's something smaller, I'll just connect them. Or if it's building something bigger, you know, we want to try to help them out. We've built, you know, 2-car garages for people, or again, just develop that relationship post-closing that maybe they never would have brought up if I hadn't sat across the table.
That's
from
smart.
Them.
I like that.
Yeah.
Great. So get past the closing here. And I mean, that's that. Right?
Yeah. I mean, for the most part,
I mean, you get your wire cashier's check and you get your profit, right?
Yeah, pretty much. You've got your profit. You then at the closing table, we usually close with one of two different title companies. We kind of mentioned it in a first episode where by paying for the closing costs up front, then you use a hold open policy, which means that I'm only paying for title insurance for the short amount of time that I owned it. And it's a drastically lower price for that title policy. Plus, I think it makes the buyers feel good when they walk in and people know us. And I've actually, we've been super, super blessed that One of the title companies that we work with actually says at the closing table, this is not your traditional flipper. These guys know what they're doing. They put a great product out there. You don't have to worry about things. So we've even had our title companies kind of just been super gracious and kind of, you know, informally, you know, endorse us, if you will. But yeah, you've gone through your settlement statement, made sure everything looks good. You've done your closing. And then we always like to have the funds wired so we're not physically moving around a check. But yeah, then you get the funds wired in your account. If you've borrowed hard money, then the title company has paid off the hard money loan and you again get those net proceeds. You've paid the real estate agents their commissions. Everybody's happy. And then, yeah, it's hopefully you've either on to looking for the next deal, or if you're trying to build that business and that system, you've got two or three more in the pipeline that you're either starting on, working on, or getting ready to finish.
Great. And then beyond that, it's just rinse and repeat, right?
Yeah. Ideally, it's just, it's rinse and repeat. It's, we don't have it as a bullet point on here, but we really do try to kind of triage and go back over each deal. If it didn't go perfectly, say, and what, you know, did we use up all of our contingency on this one and why? Or was there an anomaly of having to do a price reduction because of seasonality versus something about the house that might have been a little different, that we still looked at all these comps and try to use our best information to make the best decision, but it didn't run up like we thought it would. So we really try to analyze every deal post-mortem and just make sure that we're doing the right thing.
Do you have like an official process for that, like a formalized checklist or process, or is it more just a rough, hey, we look at the numbers and, you know, how formal is that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Right now it is informal, but that's definitely on my list for 2020, is to kind of make that more of a formalized checklist so that just as analytical as we are on the front end, let's try to be as analytical on the back end. I look at it from a big picture perspective of looking at time per deal, profit, and we measure and do averages of everything to see where we should spend our time and our money. But yeah, I don't have a like we had the 127-step checklist to do the project. I don't have a 9-step checklist, but that's something we definitely want to integrate into always improving our business so we can say, okay, great, it's done. Let's all go through it. Whether it's yourself or have a business partner or a business consultant or coach kind of analyze your deal too, definitely something that, you know, we need to be doing and getting more in depth.
Wonderful. Well, that kind of wraps up really the series there.
Yeah.
And I know we got a couple things that as we've been, putting this series on, because we record these live over about a 1.5 month period. Mm-hmm. And I know partway through, we decided to add on an 8th episode. That's not officially part of the series, but just once we get all this published, kind of just do a live Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the episode 8. And this we just talked about a few weeks ago. So we want to do something fun with this. So if you guys are watching the live one or listening to a recording of this, depending on the date, you can either listen to the recording or come join us live. But it's going to be a very informal webinar we do that has really no set agenda other than asking some questions and answers. So if you go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com/flip8, that's the number 8, you can go in there and register for it. And if you go to /Flip8Live, it'll actually take you to a survey, which has two purposes. One is you can go in there, put your questions in there to answer on the webinar. Mm-hmm. We know a lot of people, you can't make a live webinar. I usually can't make live ones, so I know most people out there can't either. If you got a question, we can make it live, put it in there. We will, do our best job to give you a detailed answer. So please give us a detailed question. But also, in our studio, we have 4 microphones. And Derek and I only use 2 of them. So we had this neat idea to invite 2 audience members to come in and do it live with us, to ask questions, hang out with us, do some networking, and just kind of hang out for a couple hours. So if you are free on, I think it's January 30th, we're doing the date. Is that it?
Yep.
And check the show notes for sure on that. And you want to come hang out with us live and commit to a couple hours that come do. I think it'll be a lot of fun. We'll chug some coffee, get jacked up on caffeine, do some questions and answers. But fill out that survey in there as well, just that way you can just confirm the time and location and pull information about yourself. Because we do want active members on there that can ask some questions and be engaging with us, not just a fly on the wall, but someone that's willing to talk on the microphone and ask some questions. Definitely do that. I think that'll be a lot of fun. And I'll put all these links out there as well. And so, Derek, I've had a lot of interest from people, say emails and short conversations here and there as we've done these series here. And I want to clear up a few things as well, because I know your group helps people flip.
Correct.
So I just want to clarify quickly, like, what services do you offer? What services don't you offer? Because I've had some people ask me if they can be put on your property distribution list.
Right.
But you don't really do email blast for wholesale deals, right?
Correct.
So do a quick what you do and don't do so people know what to contact you for.
Yeah, no, that's a really great point. So we like to try to develop kind of more intimate one-on-one relationships. And so there's three ways that we can help clients when it's the world of fix and flip. The first one is one-on-one consulting. And so that's where someone, many times those clients either have a property in their pipeline one way or the other, whether it's a family home that they're getting ready to need to sell and think that flipping it is a good way to go, whether it is they've got a number of rental properties and they're picking one of them that they're going to try to maximize their value on and they actually want to flip, or whether it's a person who wants to get into it and they are out doing their own type of marketing and networking and kind of bringing a project to the forefront. And that's us working with them one-on-one every week with myself and my team. Usually it's on average about a 3-hour type of commitment that we're helping them both on-site and also kind of in the classroom, if you will. They'll get every step of our system, both from a document standpoint and also us being on site. And so we're really coaching them through one-on-one for that specific project. And then hopefully they've got enough information and excitement on their side to do more in the future if they want. We also have the Elevation Academy that we just launched. So we work with a number of clients this past year, which was exciting, but we do kind of top out because we don't want to take on working with too many people. We want to have that kind of intimate personal experience and still flip properties on our own as a company. And so we've got a new 2-day training academy. We've got one coming up here real soon, and we anticipate doing a handful each year where it's really, really in-depth 2-day analysis where we're teaching part in the classroom and also part on site at one of our projects. And then we're going to have an alumni kind of database of working with people in the future after that. That kind of goes towards your question of, do we have a wholesale list? Now, we call it investor sailing. We don't really wholesale per se. We don't have a list of 500 people I'm going to blast it out to, not have relationship and sell off properties. We'd rather know people. I want to sell from two other people from time to time. I want to buy from them as well. Mm-hmm. So they kind of go through the academy, learn, get access to some of the projects if we've got more than we can do at any given time. And so that one is something that they'll also get that kind of continuing education. Any of the fixture and finish updates that we've talked about, of we're trying to continually evolve the business model of what buyers want, they get access to that as well. And then we also have the last and kind of more most involved way to work with us is called the partnership flip. And that's where we do two things. We either team up, teach people how to flip, where the client is bringing the property to us. Again, whether it's something that's kind of in their pipeline or they've got the funds to buy it, we actually use our funds to rehab it. We joint venture, and then we do a profit share on the back end. And then typically we use our experts to help list the property. And even if it's somebody who's a licensed real estate agent, usually it's kind of teaching them our system. And then from there, they usually kind of sell the properties on their own. But again, that's kind of bringing us the project, us really doing the work versus consulting. The client's doing the work and we're really teaching them how to do it. This one, we're really kind of running the project, doing the work ourselves, if we will, having them in our sidecar and training them, investing my company money into doing the rehab and then doing a profit share in the back end.
Wonderful. And just as we kind of wrap things up here, you know, we've put a lot of time and resource into creating this 7, now 8-part series to kind of be an evergreen piece of content for people to listen to, revisit, hopefully get some details. You can reach out to Derek to get more specifics if you need help with flipping.
Yeah.
And again, everyone knows I'm not a flipper, but I would definitely put Derek at the top of my list versus these companies that come in, you know, one weekend here and there and do the ad promotion.
Yeah, thank you.
If you have any interest, I would definitely reach out to Derek and his team to get all the details on there because they are legit. Now, going forward, I would love to hear people's thoughts in here. Just email me or as we talk because we'd like to do some type of, you know, I do monthly market updates and deal reviews, a lot for rental property stuff. But some type of ongoing, you know, market updates and just other updates from a flipping perspective, you know, because that's Derek's wheelhouse. So, you know, we've talked about doing maybe like a quarterly, some type of update, but I always want to hear what people are interested in. If you guys have like, hey, certain types of market data, deal reviews, anything that you have a request for, definitely just, you know, reach out to us or put in a survey. I would love to hear those thoughts because we would like to do some type of probably a meaty quarterly update.
Yeah.
That way people can get plugged in and just get that ongoing education. And that way they know, hey, here's what the market is doing. Here are some numbers I can expect. Here are some trends I can expect. Because things don't change quickly, but they do change slowly. And it's good to know what's going on. So you're riding growing trends versus trends from last weekend. So please let us know your thoughts on there because we want to make sure we just keep putting out good content. So, Derek, I want to thank you for all the stuff on this series here because you've been great to work with. You've put together great content. I appreciate it. And everyone out there listening, I appreciate you guys checking it out. So awesome. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Chris.